The next case on the morning's call is number 03-3244, the United States against Bonte and Hall. Mr. Herman, suppose we let the courtroom clear out so you're not distracted, okay? Thank you, Mr. Herman. I think we can get underway.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bob Herman. I am the appointed counsel for Appellant Bonte. I was also the trial counsel in this case. I have addressed my brief to one count of the conviction alone. And it is the error that I cite is a sufficiency of the evidence error. I cite this with foreknowledge that this is one of the most difficult points of appeal in this court or any other court, but I cite it with the conviction after reviewing the record that this is a serious matter, that the government has failed to adduce any evidence that supports this point during the trial and has not referred to any evidence that would support this point even on appeal in the government's response to the appeal. The problem that occurs in this count, in the count that dealt with the Mann Act conviction, is the limited way in which the government drafted the indictment. The government drafted the indictment to refer to a defined journey or interstate transportation. And that interstate transportation, as defined by the government, was a one-way trip from St. Louis to Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri to a suburb of East St. Louis, Washington Park. And although there was a trip back later, that was not included within the scope of the definition of the transportation in the government's indictment, and the government is not entitled to expand that scope at this point or during the trial without having amended the indictment first. The second problem that occurs as a result of
maybe I missed something. Your position is it's imperative that they demonstrate, or they charge an indictment that there was a two-way?
The reason, I'll get to the reason in a moment why I think this is relevant, but the government only specified
that they crossed state line.
They crossed a state line in one direction. They specified.
Well, I want to know why is it important that they took a round trip?
It's important because at some point during the trial, the government tried to convince the district court that it was a round trip. Why they didn't charge it as a round trip, I don't know.
You don't have to charge it as a round trip if the crime is committed when you cross the state line.
Well, but the intent. It's our argument that the intent to commit the particular act that was charged as a result precedent to the Mann Act occurred long after the conclusion of the trip charged and after intervening circumstances had occurred. So they can't now come along and say, well, there was a return trip and it occurred during the middle of the round trip.
But the discussion of the return trip would be important if it was necessary for charging the crime, but it is not. The Mann Act is complete when they take across the state line.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct, but
I thought you popped up with a brand new rule and I wanted
to... No, I haven't, Your Honor. I'm pointing it out that it is limited because one of the things, when I get to the seventh point, they charged it, the specific prohibited act that the government charged under the Mann Act was not sex with a minor or was not any kind of any general kind of immorality. They specifically charged sexual assault under Illinois law. Now, the question here is whether or not during the trip there was intent to commit sexual assault sometime during the trip, because if there was not intent to commit the specific act of sexual assault during the trip, there is no basis for a Mann Act violation.
What happens if it was one of several possibilities in the minds of the defendants as they made the trip? In other words, the object of the trip was clear. However, the means to obtain that end was on the subject of contingency planning. Is that enough?
Well, I'm trying to point out that the government is bound by what they charge. They charge sexual assault.
Aggravated
sexual assault. And they have to show that that was in his mind, that was a motivating factor, not the only motivating factor, but a motivating factor when he made the trip. Now,
are you saying that on the trip over to the house or wherever, his intent or whatever was to have consensual sex?
Yes.
And then when he got there, the situation changed and ultimately it became forced aggravated.
That's correct.
So and you're saying because it wasn't a round-trip charge, the one-way part, he at least says he thought these gals were up for whatever it is.
Well, that's right. That was the testimony that the girls said that they had hooked up with this with Mr. Bonte. They consensually went to purchase drugs. They consensually went to his house. Jane Doe 1 testified at trial that she consensually went back to his bedroom and spent time with him in his bedroom, only to come out and deny him consensual sex. And even the government acknowledges that at that point, the mood changed, and he decided to engage in forcible or aggravated sexual assault. There is no evidence anywhere in this trial that he intended to engage in aggravated sexual assault at any point during the transportation, and that is a requirement of a Mann Act conviction. You cannot, the government tries to say that there was a drug use and age disparity, and maturity disparity. Well, all of these things show that maybe that Mr. Bonte was interested in having sex, but they don't show that he had the intent to commit aggravated sexual assault. And unless he had that intent, he's not liable under the Mann Act. Now, he's liable for lots of things, and I'm certainly not here to tell you what a wonderful character he is. And this particular count only accounts for 15 years of the total 55-year sentence that Mr. Bonte suffered as a result of his actions. But if they can't point to some piece of evidence that shows that he had the intent to commit aggravated sexual assault during the transportation, this can't stick. I see that I reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. We'll hear now from Mr. Creel.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Wayne Creel and I represent Charles Hall. I have 2 points. First, there is no evidence to support Mr. Hall's conviction that he aided and abetted Mr. Bonte in transporting Jane 1 across state lines to commit forcible rape. And secondly, this complete lack of evidence was compounded by 2 evidentiary errors made by the trial court which deprived Mr. Hall of a fair trial. There was no evidence that Mr. Hall's conviction or to support Mr. Hall's conviction that he aided and abetted Mr. Bonte in transporting Jane 1 across state lines to commit forcible rape. Mr. Herman previously said the superseding indictment requires that the government prove Mr. Bonte's intent to commit forcible rape before the conclusion of the interstate journey. In order for the government to convict Mr. Hall, they must demonstrate that he was aware of this plan, that he associated with this plan, and that he in some way aided and abetted him in completing his plan to forcibly rape Jane Doe 1.
You going on the round-trip theory as well? It's got to be on the way and not the whole
Yes,
trip.
I agree that with Mr. Herman. That superseding indictment establishes what the trip entails. The superseding indictment says only that the trip was a one-way trip from Missouri to Illinois. Therefore, the intent must be formed before the completion of that interstate journey. And in this case, there's no evidence that that intent was formed. In fact, as the government admits in their brief, Mr. Bonney's mood changed, and he became angry. He stormed out of the room. If Mr. Bonney had not formed the requisite intent before the completion of the interstate journey, it's impossible for Mr. Hall to associate with that intent and to join in that intent and to provide any assistance. Additionally, the government can provide no evidence to any way in which Mr. Bonney was assisted by Mr. Hall. There's no evidence that he did anything other than events that occurred after the crime was completed, after the completion of the interstate journey. There's no authority, and the government cites no authority, that establishes that an aider and abetter can be convicted based on actions solely after the crime was completed. In essence, the government is attempting to fit square peg in a round hole, charging a rape case, but in federal court on Mann Act violations. There is no evidence that Mr. Bonney was assisted by Mr. Hall anyway. Additionally, this lack of evidence was compounded by two evidentiary errors. The first error was an exclusion of a statement made by Mr. Bonney to the FBI investigators and during his initial appearance that Mr. Hall had nothing to do with it. The government admits that under 804B3, a statement against penal interest can be admitted if three factors are present. First, the declarant is unavailable. It is against the penal interest of the declarant, and corroborating circumstances indicate the trustworthiness of the statement. In this case, all three prongs are met. The government agrees that Mr. Bonney, by taking the Fifth Amendment, was unavailable for trial. Additionally, the statement is against Mr. Bonney's penal interest. The fact that he says Mr. Hall had nothing to do with it, while not a direct confession, this court has upheld statements against penal interest that demonstrate a managerial, supervisory role in the crime. Mr. Bonney's statement that Mr. Hall had nothing to do with it indicates that, in fact, Mr. Bonney was the only one acting that night, and that it was Mr. Bonney that forcibly raped Jane One, and that Mr. Bonney was the one to transfer her across state lines. Additionally, sufficient corroborating circumstances exist for this statement to be admissible. This court has set out three factors to consider in discussing corroborating circumstances. The first is whether or not the declarant was attempting to curry favor with the authorities. Included in the larger statement made by Mr. Bonney, he makes several racist and derogatory comments about the victim. There's no way that he could have been making these statements with an attempt to curry favor with the authorities. He essentially admits almost every single factor needed to prove the crimes against him during his statement. He was also properly given his Miranda warnings before he made the statement, and there's no allegation or evidence of coercion. He also made the statement twice, once to the FBI and again at his initial appearance. Finally, the last factor is the relationship between the parties. And we admit that Mr. Bonney and Mr. Hall were friends, but that is not dispositive of the issue. In our brief, we cite two cases, U.S. versus Garcia and U.S. versus Paggio, which the government completely ignored. In U.S. versus Paggio, the Ninth Circuit held that a statement made by a father exonerating his son could still be admissible given sufficient corroborating circumstances. 804B3 is founded on the common sense notion that reasonable people, even people who are not especially honest, tend not to make self-inculpatory statements unless they believe them to be true. This is a finding of the U.S. Supreme Court in Williamson, and it should have been up for the jury to decide whether or not Mr. Bonney was motivated by truthfulness or desire to protect Mr. Hall. The second evidentiary issue that the trial court erred in was allowing statements that Mr. Hall made of sexual advances to Jane Two. These statements were irrelevant and improper to be admitted. The testimony had no probative value in proving the charged offense of aiding and abetting against Mr. Hall. If there was some probative value to this testimony, the slight probative value was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice to Mr. Hall. The government admits that its theory of the case is that Mr. Hall did not engage in any illegal sexual activity, rather that it's been somehow attempting to connect Mr. Hall with the sexual, immoral, and offensive acts of Mr. Bondi. This evidence was used to inflame the passions of the jury and somehow to connect Mr. Hall to the separate acts perpetrated by Mr. Bondi on Jane 1. The jury should not have been able to hear this evidence, as based on a complete lack of evidence that Mr. Hall aided and abetted Mr. Bondi, that it must have been inflamed by these statements and must have improperly connected Mr. Hall with the acts of Mr. Bondi. In conclusion, there is no evidence to support the charge of aiding and abetting against Mr. Hall for the acts of Mr. Bondi in transporting Jane 1 across state lines with the intent to commit forcible rape. This lack of evidence was compounded by the fact that the government, that the trial court made two evidentiary errors which deprived Mr. Hall of a fair trial. These charges should be reversed, or an alternative, he should be granted a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Creel. We'll hear now from Ms. Morrissey.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'll first address Mr. Bondi's claim, since that seems to be the gravamen of both defendants' arguments in this case. The argument, I believe, is based, Your Honors, on asking this court basically to find a loophole and to set artificial limits under the Mann Act that don't exist and aren't supported by the case law. Let me say, first of all, that should this court determine that the defendant's intent to have engaged in forcible sexual conduct had to be formed before the state line was crossed.
When you think Bang put that to rest some years ago.
I agree with Your Honor, and Bang is the case that I relied on heavily in determining how to proceed in this case, Your Honor. Bang is the case that says that it is proper for the jury to consider evidence occurring after the defendant crossed the state line in determining what their intent was when they crossed it. In any event, the evidence in this case supported that Mr. Bondi, when he prowled a teenage hangout, a mall on a Friday night, approaching young women, suggesting that they go driving around with him, giving them a sense of security, or trying to impress them with his employment as a record producer. All these things establish that Mr. Bondi was bent on a course of having sex with one or more of these juveniles that night, and he was going to get that one way or another. If it happened to ultimately result in rape, as it did in this case, that wasn't something Mr. Bondi was opposed to doing. There was additional evidence that Mr. Bondi intended to resort to whatever means were necessary to get what he wanted in this case. He took these juveniles to a particular location. He took them to a house in Washington Park, Illinois, a city that is known for its high crime rate and for the number of strip clubs on every corner. This house was, the windows and doors of this house were secured with steel bars. It was a neighborhood that the children found frightening. And Mr. Bondi and Mr. Hall both encouraged that impression by telling the children that if they would try to leave, they were likely to be killed, they were likely to be shot, that white people in this neighborhood weren't likely to survive very long. So all of these actions of Mr. Bondi and also of Mr. Hall show that they were bent on having sex with what ultimately turned out to be Jane 1, one way or the other. So I do agree with the court that Vang puts this issue to rest, raised by Herman here this morning, that the court properly instructed this jury based on Vang, and for all those reasons, Your Honor, I would urge this court to uphold the district court. That, let me then turn just briefly to the evidentiary rulings of the district court with respect to Mr. Hall, I believe that those issues have all been adequately addressed in the brief, that there's nothing new that's presented here this morning. I would invite questions on those evidentiary rulings if the court desires to ask me any questions.
You maintain, of course, that Mr. Bondi's statement was not a declaration against interest. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
He was just, what, trying to throw him off the track or what?
He was trying to help his best friend, is what he was trying to do.
What was he doing to himself in that process?
Well, the statement looked, if you look at that statement by itself, I'm not sure what he was trying to do to himself. I think the statement shows, as the district court found, that he was simply trying to help his friend, that it didn't help or hurt Bondi, which is what's required, that it hurt him.
Wasn't that admission on his part that he did whatever he's accused of?
No, I don't believe it is, Your Honor. I believe that the statement, Hall had nothing to do with it, was simply that. Hall had nothing to do with it. I'm trying to help my best friend. It didn't implicate Bondi. And I think if you look also at the statement as a whole, Bondi certainly wasn't intentionally implicating himself. Now, certainly the statement as a whole was against Bondi's penal interest in certain respects, but Bondi didn't have that intent. Bondi's intent in giving his statement to the FBI was to exonerate himself. He claimed, for example, that the sex was consensual. He claimed that he believed the girls were over the age of 18. He claimed that there was no force, that in fact, if any...
Is this all in the part of the same statement?
It was all part of the same statement.
So I didn't do anything, and he didn't have anything to do with it, is what he said.
Right. I didn't do anything wrong, and he didn't do anything. That's what
he didn't have anything to do with it.
Okay. Right. Now, as my colleague points out, there was a second statement by Mr. Bondi to Judge Proud, Magistrate Judge Proud, at his, I believe it was an initial appearance or detention hearing, one of the preliminary.
He didn't have anything to do with it. Same thing.
Same thing. I keep trying to tell the FBI my friend had nothing to do with this, and they won't listen to me. Again, he's trying to help his friend.
Yeah.
I think that was a reasonable interpretation by the district court. The standard is
would you handle it all the way through?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Were you the trial counsel at that level?
Yes, sir.
And you objected to that?
Yes, sir, I did.
It seems to me to be a purposeless objection. What difference does it make?
Well, looking back,
I
don't know that it would have made a difference had the evidence come in, Your Honor. And
all you do is add an imponderable to an already imponderable situation. So I don't see the purpose of the objection. But go ahead. I mean, it's not before us. That's not an issue. I was just curious.
Looking back, you may be right that maybe it was an objection that, in hindsight, I should have let go. But it was a closer case on Mr. Hall, and it was a very serious case involving very horrible facts. And so sometimes in hindsight, 20/20.
Yeah.
But the point is, I think that the district court...
Well, it is now we have to determine whether or not that affected the outcome of the case.
Right, whether it affected the outcome. And again, Your Honor, I don't see how it could have. As the district court found, Bondi was in a room locked up with this juvenile for 3 hours, during which time Hall was doing several things that the government alleged aided and abetted this offense. So, as the court found, there really were no circumstances corroborating the statement that Hall had nothing to do with it. Bondi had no way of knowing what Hall was doing for the 3 hours he was in the room with Jane Doe 1. So I don't see how it could have affected the outcome of the trial.
Correct me if I'm wrong, neither party could testify, did they?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. If there's no further questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you, Ms. Morrison.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 1 minute, Mr. Harmon.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, Vang doesn't solve this problem because while Vang says you can use evidence of what happened later to determine intent, you still have to have intent to bring...
But he said the fact that he, even a consensual, your intent to have consensual sex is irrelevant. If you wind up doing it across the state line for sex and you get all...
Right. Right. The government is trying to make an impermissible inference that any person who doesn't, who wants sexual relations that gets spurned in his advances is going to immediately resort to...
Crossing the state line for purposes of having sexual encounter is sufficient under Fang.
It may be if it's charged that way, but it's
No. It's irrelevant when you get to the end. They don't have to charge that you went over for consensual sex. You went over and say you committed rape. And then you say, I went over for consensual sex, and it doesn't make a particle of difference under Vang.
I'm not sure I read Vang that way, Your Honor, but...
Well, there you go.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Creel, your time had expired, so we will take the case at that point under advisement. With our thanks to both Mr. Herman and Mr. Creel for having accepted their appointments and have been of great assistance to the court by their fine work on behalf of their clients. Indeed, our thanks to all counsel in the case. And the case will be taken under advisement.